Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. Today, I have Kat McCrabb. She's absolutely brilliant, incredibly smart GRC professional. She runs a consultancy called Flametree Cyber, and I was really excited to bring her on because I know that her discipline is in the education space, specifically in schools and universities and federal government. And what I liked about Kat is that not only is she also previously a Novacastrian, but she has a little bit of a sardonic sense of humor, but also brings a wealth of knowledge and experience into these conversations. So I hope that you have a fun time listening to her, and go say hello, hi to her if you are up in Brisbane. I'm sure that she would love to have a coffee with you, or essentially get bird spray and spray you with those, because we see them at all the coffee shops with the crazy ibises on now anyway. So, right, enjoy. Hello, everybody. Today, I'm joined by Kat McCrabb, who is the founder of Flametree Cyber. Kat, how's it going today?
It's really good. I had my air conditioning repaired earlier today, and life has really improved since then.
You know, air conditioning, I would like to get the ones you stick on the walls and you have to get the stuff on the outside, but we have ducted. But the problem with the ducts in my house is that they're all yellow and from like 1910.
Oh, yes.
And so the guy, I've had two air conditioner blokes come over, walk into the ceiling, look at me and said, "Oh, mate, she's carked it." It'll be like $1 billion for me to fix and I can't be bothered. So I'll see you in 2 to 3 years. So
nice.
And at that point, I've just said, like, I guess the air conditioning isn't happening because I don't really have anywhere to put my air conditioners so that they can have the outside, face outside and the inside in the house. So it's probably a significantly worse problem for you being in Brisbane, right?
I've made do. It's been most of the summer, but I will confess it's nice to have a little bit of climate control.
I guess like what we do is we just go to libraries and customer sites and then we're okay, right? We don't have to worry about our own air conditioning. We can leech off everyone else's. So that's the purpose of Westfield, right?
That in the cinema.
Yeah, that's it. Sit in the back of the cinema. I just got to take a Zoom call and it's like nice and dark here, full cyber. So don't worry, no one's going to watch this movie. Who comes to the cinemas anymore? But anyway, moving away from those like kind of niceties, do you want to give everyone a little bit of a background besides being someone who recently acquired air conditioning, one of the greatest things you could get in Australia?
Yes. My name is Kat McCrabb. I started out my career in federal government. I was there for about 12 years. And then I moved into Brisbane Catholic Education in their CISO role, had a really significant program of uplift there. And most recently, I've started Flametree Cyber with the intention of helping as many mission-driven organizations as I can.
Yeah. So did you want to expand on that a little bit? When you say mission-driven organization, what does that mean to you? Because I mean, a lot of people might think it's because they've got a charitable purpose, but others, their mission is just to make shit tons of money. So,
yeah. Well, yes, valid point. I'm looking more at the organizations that have a purpose that isn't purely driven by financials.
Yeah. So what kind of organizations for my audience are you like your perfect customer bases?
Yep. So I work with government, with organizations that support government, in the non-for-profit area and healthcare, those sorts of industries.
Yeah, I think it's quite challenging to get access to good cybersecurity advice, and especially for those sectors, because often they're priced out of the market or they're grappling with just a lot of problems that bigger businesses have invested in projects and uplift to be able to take care of. But it's kind of harder to do that when you're an NFP or government agency.
Absolutely. And often they have these fairly, let's call it prescriptive control environments or frameworks that they're trying to align to. And that can just add a whole layer of complexity to managing cyber in those organizations.
So when we say prescriptive controls, what are we talking about here? Because
Well, the best example of that is the frameworks and control environments that government have to operate within. And equally, if you're a critical infrastructure organisation, you're supplying to government. So the ISM, that's really quite rigid. And then when you move into the critical infrastructure area, you're looking at aligning to the Essential 8 maturity level 2 now. Similarly, if you're a supplier for defence, you've got the DISP environment that you have to operate within. So if you've not got a cyber background or a technology background and suddenly you're obliged to operate within that framework, there's definitely a lot of value in getting external advice.
Yeah, I find that there's been a definite uptick in companies that accelerate compliance outcomes. So like the Cytales and Vantas and all of them of the world to try to assist with this. Do you think those companies are helping to get people to just achieve those outcomes, or do you think those companies are meaningfully improving security?
I think they're doing a really good job of getting people to increase their compliance. That's very helpful, but sometimes organizations need to take a bit of a step back, understand the threats and their risk, and that is a more meaningful benefit to them to improve their risk posture or their threat posture and understand exactly what the cybersecurity concerns are for their own organization.
I guess like you say threat posture, risk posture, what do you mean by that? Like how does an organization determine like what their posture is in the first place? Like I guess like having a compliance framework is helpful, but...
It is helpful. It's a reasonable start. In the threat modeling space, I quite like the MITRE ATT&CK framework. So using that to understand exactly who, understanding who might be after your organization, and you can get that information from research that's available or, again, the consulting with expertise, and using those frameworks to understand exactly what techniques, threats might be using against you, ensuring that you make your control environment appropriate to mitigate those threats.
So with MITRE ATT&CK, because the threat intelligence space to me is like kind of an area I don't really understand or pay terribly much attention to. I'll be very honest about that. And the reason I'm like that is like I figure that there's just so much baseline like IT quality management that we need to do. And I've just figured that if you're a threat actor, like, yeah, you can have all of these sophisticated like techniques and procedures and tradecraft and spycraft even or whatever, but if everybody just leaves like, you know, large like vast sums of applications with basic vulnerability classes like SQL injection or cross-site scripting, do you actually need to worry all that much about like the TTPs when you can't just get your shit in order?
You raise a valid point, and it is for a more mature organization. If you've got Windows XP across your environment, having a stronger understanding of who your threat actors are and your TTPs is, efforts might be better spent elsewhere. But equally, it can really help with understanding if you've got a limited budget on controls. Understanding the TTPs can help you to allocate that budget towards the area where you're going to get the most value for money. It can also help you with determining what skill sets you need within your teams, so the expertise that you bring on, and making sure that you are defending yourself against what's actually going to effectively target you and the most likely outcomes of events. You can also use it when you're looking at incident response. You might be mid-incident and you've got some idea of who your threat actor is, and then you can gain a bit of an understanding of what may have happened to perpetuate that incident, and you can start to cut it off a little bit more effectively and target your incident response efforts.
Yeah, because you've had to be involved in a number of incident response scenarios yourself. It's a sector that, you know, I've taken active steps over my life to try not to participate in DDR situations. I'm happy to solve issues in advance, to strategize, to solve, like, to work out plans and roadmaps and focus on protection and detection. And I've never really wanted to do the response or recovery remediation aspects. How's that been, like, you know, having, because I know that that's something that you're potentially going to be talking about at a conference I'm running later this year as well, the Slash New conference, right?
Great. Yeah, it's prevention is better than cure. 100%. I'd rather spend my time in that space. I'd have less gray hair. But
I think that everybody in cybersecurity either goes bald or gets significantly grayer hair. The funniest thing, I was looking at some statistics on my podcast recently, and I just looked at most of the, a lot of my male guests happen to be old, bald men, and I wonder if they've all worked in IR capacity.
Yeah. Yep. I wouldn't put money on it, but I'd be close to doing that. But yes, prevention. Far better than QR. When I've done incident response, quite often when you walk into the boardroom, one of the earliest questions you get is, what happened? What went wrong? What can we do to fix it? These sorts of, let's call it attribution questions. And that's not about assigning blame. It's just they're coming from a place of wanting to understand. And so knowing your TTPs can be really helpful for understanding, it's this threat actor. This is likely what has occurred. It's a common technique that they use. This is likely how it will play out. We have triggers for responding to those events that we anticipate will happen when the threat actor enacts their usual path. And this is the plan that we'll use to bring our systems, contain the incident, do the remediation and recovery activities. So when you can use a framework to anchor that conversation, it first of all helps to demonstrate your credibility and it builds confidence, and then it helps guide decision making.
Yeah, it comes up in a lot of my conversations. Am I spending my money effectively, and where do I need to be spending it to get an adequate level of protection for my investment? Because I know that as a cybersecurity professional, we often think of in terms of capabilities and coverage. I think that most executives don't really like to think in terms of assets and not as assets protected. It's more about, is my business able to execute safely, and what's the cost if something does go wrong? So how do you go about using a framework like MITRE ATT&CK to apportion costs appropriately?
That's a difficult one. I'm not sure I have a straight answer for you there, because there's...
That's the thing. There's a reason that you have a CISO level role, is because you can have those strategic conversations, and it always goes back down to diagnosing what the problem is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And understanding the organization's priorities and their risk tolerance and appetite, and prioritizing your efforts where the business's priorities are. If I spend time and effort on an area of the organization that is a lower priority, and something happens in the critical system space, that's a very difficult conversation to have with the board when you're asked those questions. In the education space, the greatest priority was in protecting students and their welfare. So that's where the majority of efforts went. If I'd spent some time working on, let's protect the financial system, and something happened to a student, well, first of all, I'm not sure I'd be able to sleep at night for a long time. But secondly, I know I'm going to get asked questions about that, because that is the priority.
I think that's one of the reasons the CISO role is quite challenging, is you need to be able to take a step away from any of the technical context whatsoever, and like actually really, really meaningfully understand what your stakeholders across your business do care about before you go about anywhere near building a security program. I guess like then, rather than thinking about, oh, where do I portion costs, what would you say is a good way to then present this information to those stakeholders to convince them to spend money? Because this conversation happens a lot. I speak with a lot of head of securities, like security managers, even CISOs in smaller, like they have a CISO title, but they're in a smaller business. If they're in a big business, usually they know what they're doing. And they say, how do I get more money, or how do I convince people about the need for this? So, but yeah, framework makes sense. But what's been successful for you, other than just like crying wolf, which I think personally is ineffective. So
I would have to agree with that. If you start crying wolf and it never happens, you've lost trust and you've lost credibility, and it makes every subsequent conversation really difficult. I like to leverage other stakeholders in the business. I go speak to legal. I speak to heads of risk, compliance, assurance, internal audit. They're going to help me to build my context of the organization's priorities. Audit is a really great example. because you can speak to them about, well, what areas of the organization do my board or executive want you to provide assurance over? That helps me to understand priorities. Whenever you can anchor the security conversation or the technology conversation to those organizational priorities, you're a step ahead, especially if you can have those business areas advocating on your behalf. You can speak with legal counsel about the privacy risk. You speak to your fraud team about digital fraud that's enabled or fraud that's enabled through technology, and just help build that holistic picture across the organization that technology is an enabler of most business functions. And when it's at risk, business functions are at risk. Aligning really strongly with the enterprise risk framework is also really beneficial. I look at monthly metrics and measures and ensure that they align with that enterprise risk framework. The metrics and measures that are easily understood, it also becomes a bit of an education piece for the board. My report goes up monthly. I'm going to use that as an opportunity to explain why multi-factor is important. Anchoring it to current events in the news is really important. I never waste a good crisis. When Optus, Medibank, those are the two really common high-profile examples in Australia. When those occurred, immediately executive briefing, this is what we believe happened in those organisations and this is how we're postured against those threats and risk. All of that helps to build confidence and credibility. And then when you do say, look, I've got a concern in this area, it relates to this enterprise risk. You've had an audit report in that area that has also demonstrated a weakness. I think it could be exploited through XYZ. May I please have funding? Very often you will receive that funding.
You got to be able to be logical and back it up with data from different business units so you can show that you've done your due diligence, right? You're not just saying,
exactly.
I just really need to get a SIEM. It's really important.
Yeah, it's a fun tool. It's retention strategy.
Yeah, it was just so good. You know, I went and had drinks with these guys and they just said to me, buy the SIEM. And now I just feel like I need to. Doesn't work so well when the board's like, so a little bit of question because this one's a bit expensive now. So
yeah, especially if it's got a lot of OPEX and the OPEX increases every year. But I also like to really demonstrate that you've tried to get value from the tools that you've already got. I think that's really important when you're requesting funding.
Yep. So I know that you mentioned doing things that are incredibly relevant for the business. And I know that like some of my previous guests have been all over the different shop. And I guess even just in my business, I interact with companies from either small, really small businesses, they're just starting up to like really big established ones. And some like the conversations I have are so different between the two. Like some places when I speak to them are not, there's figure that they can just like pass off all the risk to cyber insurance and it will solve all of their problems, right? Or they think that, yeah, like my biggest issue is being able to ship products when actually the biggest issue is if their Instagram account gets compromised, then they're not going to get any funnel and then they can't, because no one is getting any marketing, no one's going to come to the website. And in my view, that's like more backbreaking than anything else that they could be doing wrong. Then you got the big businesses who are saying, oh, we just have like hundreds of billions of dollars of gift card fraud happening constantly. We don't know what to do about it, right? So, and you're like, gift cards, gift card preventions, gift card expiries, get like all of these different weird things to do with gift cards I would have never thought about except for the concept of a large retail business, right? So I always enjoy that. But going back to what you really do care about, which is not so much just making big companies make more money in a safe way, is that mission-driven one. What would you say if you have like a company with a very specific mission, would you always be aiming to just make them achieve the mission and have security controls that align with that? Is that the most important thing in your view?
I like to look at the desired business outcomes, and often they're mission supportive, but sometimes they can be a little bit adjacent. So you may have an organization that has their core service offering, but one of their business objectives is to offer donations to a particular community or something like that. And so, yes, I can offer you cybersecurity that helps you achieve your mission, or equally, I can offer you a security program that aligns with all of your objectives, not all of which might support your mission.
Yeah, and that's always going to be a tough conversation, because sometimes, like, to be able to achieve your mission, you have to be able to pull it back a little bit, because you need to have some controls and guardrails in place. You know, we can't let all the IT people free to go off and do whatever, or we'll end up like the United States. You know, it's just I just don't think that's where we want to be. So
we'd have some really shiny tools, though.
I do like shiny tools. I'm just gonna have to go invest in lots of startups and do angel investing or something, and just see what's around, and just tell people, give me your shiny tools, let me look at them.
I wish you luck.
Oh, we'll see how we go. Moving away from shiny schools and then back to the federal government, but not to the United one. We're going to talk about the Australian one. So I know you say you did a lot of work in the Australian government sphere, and that means you must be incredibly familiar with the PSPF, the ISM, and the Essential 8. So I've always felt like the E8's designed for fleets of thousands of Windows devices and Active Directory Forest and Outlook. And so I've almost never looked at it. And the reason I've never really looked at it is because every company that I tend to service is going to be having like fleets of MacBooks connected to a single OAuth provider that then has a bunch of different very bespoke SaaS services to deliver very specific functionality. And everyone's just doing software dev, right? So it's a very different type of environment. And it means that when I have chats with a lot of government agencies who focus on Essential 8, it's a very like, you know, I talk past them constantly. Like I get it. I understand the value of like patching. I understand the value of limiting administrative privileges. I just think that it's not particularly relevant for a lot of the sectors that I participate in. And apparently that's what's mandated across all agencies. What do you think of Essential 8? And are there some limitations to it? Or is it fit for purpose today?
Yeah, it has its value. When it was first created and it was the top four, and I could be misquoting this very slightly, but they used to say it would mitigate between 80 to 85% of threats. And I mean, that's a pretty good outcome, really, if that happened to be correct at the time. But we have changed a lot in the last 15 years. The move to cloud has been, I was going to say rapid, but actually perhaps it hasn't been as rapid as I thought.
I still know places who are saying, hey, look, it's time for us to lift and shift. I'm like, oh God, what are we working in? It's lift and shift. I haven't heard that term since 2015. Gosh. Anyway.
It's some days I feel old, some days I feel young.
Hey, we're young at heart, and we're still not like jaded about our industry. We love it. We're still having fun, right?
So yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic metric of success, isn't it? But yeah, back then when it was the top four and it was 80 to 85% of threats, very appropriate for the environment in which we operated. Nowadays, shift to SaaS, likely less appropriate. It is very technology focused. It's definitely not a comprehensive security strategy, but there are a few people process controls in it. And I like to ensure that any framework I come up with or even strategy has those people process pieces of the puzzle filled in. User education is a really great example of that. We all say the user is the weakest link. I say they're your greatest opportunity. Most organizations will advocate for investing in user education. The Essential 8 really doesn't have very much in that space. So it had its place a long time ago. Nowadays, I'd love to see whether that 80 to 85% statistic still holds up.
Yeah, I actually really dislike when people say, oh, yeah, the users are the weakest link. And, you know, because then you're basically victim blaming. I personally just dislike it. The other thing I really dislike is the us versus them metaphors it creates, because by treating those like people that you train as, you know, effectively internal adversaries, like instead of like, you know, people who want to assist and help you to keep the organization secure. Like, why are we creating these like walls and barriers? So Essential 8's hard for me because I speak to a lot of like smaller businesses, and it can be extremely hard to tell them, okay, so you have like five laptops or something and they need app control on them. So, and they're like, oh, but I use it for my accounting and I use it for my son's school, and then he can't use it for school. And then I use it for, oh, of course, we'll never tell the ATO that we're using it for my son's school. Got to portion the device correctly, right? We're good business owners. No one in the ATO listen to this. The podcast is over. It's not me. But other people, I know plenty of people, but still they're gonna be in situations like that where it's not easy to just do something like disallowing everything on your device, because if you do that, then you're in a situation where you can't actually, you know, be nimble enough to respond to events. So, or you'll lock yourself out. And that's even worse from a security perspective than being compliant. Like, I was talking to a school, funnily enough, up this way in Newcastle. I won't mention which one. And the IT administrator was like, oh, well, we've been told to do multi-factor authentication across all of the students' laptops. And I basically sat him down and I was like, mate, I don't know how you're going to do that, because, you know, it's just three things. Is if you give students like a hard token or whatever, they're probably just going to, like they did with all of the bloody bikes and scooters and stuff you saw, just throw them into the ocean and laugh at you. So, because kids are destructive and annoying.
No hat, no play. Just like that.
And then, what's next is, okay, well, how about biometrics? I'm sure that there's going to be something about privacy oriented with like storing facial identification or thumbprints or whatever of kids. I just can't see that working out particularly well. And then you're basically stuck, right, to having one factor, which is something you know, right? Or like maybe give them but even if they say, oh, let's use a mobile device or something, well, all the schools in New South Wales have a ban on using phones during school hours. So how the hell is that going to work? So we sort of, you know, the compliance framework, you can never get beyond maturity level zero, because you literally cannot comply with this in any circumstances because of the operating environment of the school. And that's just schools. I'm sure plenty of other places have different types of constraints, but yeah, he walked away and did a big think because he wasn't sure how to tell his boss that he couldn't do it. So,
fair enough. Now, it is a multi-factor, is a really great example of the complexities of implementing the Essential 8 across industries. And in education, we didn't do multi-factor for students, we did it for teachers, but they're not allowed to have their phones within the classroom. So we had to have some creative solutions around where multi-factor was enforced and where it wasn't. Similarly, application hardening or application control, quite difficult when you're in an education setting and there's a tremendous diversity of applications in use. And I think it comes back again to that risk tolerance and appetite. We've got the CIA triad. Organizations will prioritize different aspects of that triad. In the education space, there were certain data which the confidentiality of it was very important, but there were other aspects of the organization where availability was the greatest priority. And so you've got to really balance that across different environments and the business objectives and organizational priorities.
I know that I was chatting to like another company that's involved in the education sector, and we were able to do something with modifying data that students would love to increase for a very specific reason when they're approaching university. And I was like, this is fun. And he's just like, oh, no, this is backbreaking. God, we can't do this. So, like, integrity matters too. It's all about the context, right? And and that's why I always kind of rail against like compliance frameworks. So not just because I feel left out, because I do. I feel like Australia just doesn't care about software security. We don't have anything in any of our frameworks. Like even the ISM alone just has like two lines saying, "Do the OWASPs." And what does that even mean? What is do the OWASPs? Is it like do ASVS, like level three? Is it do the top 10? Is it follow like, I don't know, SAM? Like what is an OWASP? So, and I don't think that's particularly helpful for any agency. They just kind of skip over it, right? But increasingly, all of these federal agencies are relying on digital services and building their own applications internally. And we just don't have any governance or approach other than telling them to monitor applications that are running on their devices and patch their software, which it's good. I just think the world's changed.
Yeah, I think they're a great starting point. If you're an organization that's never done cyber before, a framework's a really good way of trying to target your thinking and your understanding and build some maturity. But once you've reached a certain level of understanding, moving more into that threat risk-based approach is going to really help you to target your efforts where you'll get the most advantage from them.
So changing gears a little bit, because we've only got a little bit of time left. So I heard recently that you got some kind of position with Acer in Brisbane, right?
Yeah. So I'm on the Queensland committee, which is fantastic. It's I'm looking at how I can help contribute to BrisSec and just build more of that community up here. Everyone, when they ask me, what do you love the most about cyber? My answer is community. So it's really wonderful to be able to spend a bit of time giving back to the community and hopefully move into some mentoring spaces as well. There's a group up here that do mentoring for defence veterans and law enforcement officials that want to move in cyber. So I'm really hoping that I can help out a little bit in that space as well.
Yeah. So what are your plans for Acer for the year then? So or how long's your term? I don't understand. I'll admit that I haven't joined professional communities. I've kind of created them myself. So
Yeah, no, fair enough. It's early days and I've only been to one meeting thus far. But I'll be contributing to the panel at the end of BrisSec, so I'll be facilitating that and putting my hat in the ring for a couple of events during the year. So from Queensland, you're listening to this, you've got an idea for what you'd like Acer to do in Queensland this year, let me know. I'm more than happy to try and help out and make it happen.
Well, I guess I'll be hitting you up a couple of times then, Kat. So look, everybody, you should all give some feedback to Kat, see what she can do to support growing the cybersecurity community in Queensland. I personally love going to the Gold Coast and to Brisbane and seeing all my friends. In fact, one time I had a great experience with Kat because we got to sit down in a cafe together and we kept having all these bin chickens walking up to us. But at all of our tables, we had these spray bottles where you could just spray water with quite a strong force at these chickens, and they would just like start walking away. And all of the bottles on them had like bird spray written on them, so it was clearly their intention. It was just such a fun activity. So you know, I encourage you to go to the Brisbane South Bank waterfront, find that one cafe with like a tealy light color, and then spray bin chickens repeatedly.
We'll admit it was a good way to start the day.
Yeah, get rid of some of your cyber frustrations by shooting little chickens of water that are trying to eat your like bacon and eggs in the morning. So
that's it.
Anyway, Kat, thank you so much for coming on the Secured Podcast. It was great to listen to you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Secured. If you got any feedback at all, feel free to hit us up and let us know. If you'd like to learn more about how Galah Cyber can help keep your business secured, go to galahcyber.com.au. If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage, and I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.